The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman on News Talk
with Kia.
Now, our first guest is a household name, and this week he has been thrown into the limelight, but for very personal reasons. Tommy Fleming and his wife Tina have ended their marriage of 20 years, and since that news broke at the weekend, there has been a lot in the public domain and online, including an explosive voice message with lots of personal information put out there about Tommy himself. And Tommy joined me in studio a little earlier to tell us the reasons for the end of their marriage and to speak his own truth. I should warn you that there are some aspects of this interview that discuss mental health and other sensitive issues, so some people may find this discussion triggering. I began by asking Tommy why he wanted to join us today.
I'd love to say to set the record straight, but it's wrong choice of words in some places, but to give my side of it to honestly, Ciara, to give you my truth. That's why I'm here.
Okay. Your marriage to Tina, long-standing. You met her in 2002, you got married in 2006, and we now hear just this weekend past that you separated last October 2025. Tell us what led you to that point.
We separated actually on the 17th of September. And what led to it was a lot, many years of just, this year we would have been 20 years married. For at least 10, 13 years of marriage, we were very happy. But small cracks started to appear, mainly for me. And small cracks that were never mended, and with every crack that appeared, there was a new crack and a new crack, and those cracks became a chasm. And there was, I wasn't happy with my own situation. I wasn't happy, and it wasn't about being happy. It was about being uncomfortable with the situation, if that makes sense. I'd been living a lie for all my life, really. And the hardest part of that was the energy and the effort it took for this lie to be constantly covered and to be, I suppose, protected. And that lie was that I'm gay. And, wow.
Have you ever said that out loud in public before?
Not to this many people. Yeah. I'm gay. And I'm finally living my truth. I'm finally being honest, being able to live a life that's true and real and just honest.
Let me take you right back, okay? You were thrust into the limelight as a young man. You were singing. You supported Phil Coulter. You were 22 years of age in Carnegie Hall. Loads of things happening in your life that you probably could have only dreamed of as a lad from Sligo. All during that time, did you know then you were gay?
If I'm honest, yeah. But the 55-year-old man that looks back at that 22-year-old kid are two very, very different people. Two very different people. Lying to yourself at 22 is an easy thing to do. But as the years go by, you just find it an awful lot harder. And the 22-year-old kid really kind of... And what I mean by lying to yourself, it wasn't that you were trying to say you weren't gay. It was you lived a straight life and you had girlfriends and you had all of that. But you told yourself you weren't. And that was it, and you didn't act on it.
And I presume you didn't want to be.
No, I didn't. Not in 1991. It was a very different country. It was a very... And you have to remember also, as a 13-year-old kid, who knew, to be honest with you, and I come home and I'm in second year in school.
All boys school?
No, mixed school. Banada Abbey. It's closed now, but in Sligo. And I remember it was in around 1984, 85, and it was at the height of the AIDS epidemic and crisis. And every evening on the news, there was something about, you know, just from San Francisco, it was always these just awful stories. And my uncle was in the house in my home place with some other neighbour, I can't even remember who it was, and they were watching the TV with this guy that was had about, I'd say he had a week to live. And he was telling his story, to which one of them turned around and said, they should be burned alive.
The gays.
Mm.
Okay.
So when you're a 13-year-old kid and you know what you are, you run back in under that ground as quick as you can, mm-hmm. when your own family would have said something like that.
And in rural Ireland in those days, and not even just rural, urban Ireland as well, it was a very different time, and we didn't even decriminalise homosexuality here until 1996. So I get it. I do. Having said that, you went on. You met Tina in 2002, got married.
2002.
Did you ever feel, and this is a hard question, did you ever feel guilty marrying her but knowing that maybe your heart or your head wasn't fully in it?
Honestly, no, because Tina, I what I call the bisexual phase, and Tina knew about that. That was the very first thing I said to her. It was the very, very first thing I said when we met, that I had been in a relationship with a man, that we'd broken up 6 months, I think, prior. And then we started to go out. But she had a full knowledge of that. But I was going through the bisexual phase. And again, you're lying to yourself, but you've done it so much that you actually believe your own lies.
So are you saying, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but that you felt that being bisexual was somehow more acceptable than being gay, so therefore you were bisexual?
Yeah, that you liked both men and women, and and then there was always the jokes and the running commentary of, oh, you're greedy. You know that, and it was...
I've heard that said.
Yeah, and... You know, but as the years went on, I just knew. And it got harder and it became so difficult in the end that there wasn't a morning I didn't wake up with that awful, awful pain. It's not a physical pain. Somebody said once, is it butterflies? No, it's not. It's bats. That's what it is. It's not...
Like a psychic pain, an emotional pain.
You just know that you're always on guard. You're always afraid.
There's one thing about knowing that your husband is bisexual, or thinking that he's bisexual. I know you're not. You're gay. But there's one thing about knowing that. Lots of people will know that their husband is straight, but they still won't want him to be with other women. Was there a period in the beginning of your marriage where you understood your own sexuality but you didn't act on it?
Absolutely. My train of thought would have been, it doesn't matter whether it's a woman or a man, if you're looking and you're looking to stray, it's gone, it's over. It's simple, and that's where I was with that. And as the years went on and the relationship drifted, the relationship had different directions.
Of course, not only was Tina your wife, she's also your manager, so you worked closely together as well as being married.
And a great job she did. She did, you know, and I will never take that away. And sometimes that made life more difficult, because you lived together, you worked together, you socialised together. We were always in each other's pocket. And it just, like many, like thousands of marriages every day, we just started to drift apart.
Okay. Do you remember, can you remember back to the first time you did stray?
Well, that's a good question. Yeah, I can. And I would have told myself, I tried to, not console, that's the wrong word, I was trying to convince myself that it was all right because it was anonymous.
Okay.
It wasn't an affair in my head.
People do make that distinction in their heads. An affair is real cheating because it's an emotional connection.
Yeah, but come on, let's call a spade a shovel here, shall we?
How did you feel afterwards?
Oh, God. The guilt was always... And then you try and take the pain away of the guilt by... You'd sit down with a bottle of wine, two bottles maybe, and you think, right, for 2 or 3 hours of that, sitting down having the glass of wine or whatever it was, that pain is gone and the guilt is gone. And, God, you woke up the next morning and it was 10 times worse. The anxiety was...
Was the anxiety about being caught, or was the anxiety about the fact that maybe you were about to blow up your own life?
I think a little of both. Not a little. I think very, very, very shared measures of both. And you would always kind of go, you know, you would always, like, in your head you're going, why did I do that?
Did you tell yourself you wouldn't do it again?
Oh yeah, constantly. You know, it's like when you went off cigarettes for the first time and I'm never going to do that again. And, you know, you lie to yourself. You lie and you believe the lie. And you just keep going.
But as you said, the lie got harder to maintain. Is that because the double life, the balance in the double life was shifting away from maintaining the marriage and dabbling in your sexuality over here on the side? But ultimately that started to grow legs?
No. Being honest with you, it was more of the... What's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to use the word craving. It wasn't like that. It was more like a yearning of the real me. And I knew every day I walked in life, I was not the real me.
Did you feel trapped?
Yeah, 100%. But trapped within my own creation, within my own body of lies, within my own bubble that I had created. And that was a huge part of it.
Did many people, obviously the public didn't know this about you, Tommy, but did people within your life, in your inner circle, was this known, that this was what was going on for you?
Some of the closest people to me, yeah, I would have told them. I had to be able to say it out loud at some point. And to say it out loud to one person even lifted a bit of the burden.
And what about Tina? Did she know the full extent of what was going on?
No, not full extent. Until there was a telephone conversation that was made from St. Pat's.
Because you were in St. Pat's last year.
I was in St. Pat's getting treatment. I was admitted to St. Pat's on the 13th of October. This is a show about truth, right?
Mm-hmm.
On the 21st of September, I attempted suicide with an overdose. Sorry.
It's okay, you can take a minute, don't be worrying. Tell me, what did something specific precipitate that, or was it that just... the snowball effect of everything.
An overwhelming sense of absolute sadness and hopelessness. And the fact that it would be so much easier if I wasn't here.
Easier for who, Tommy?
I didn't think that one out.
Okay. So you attempted that, you took the overdose and you were in St. Pat's now. And then what happened?
I was admitted to St. Pat's for treatment for acute depression, anxiety.
Did you tell the doctors in St. Pat's about your sexuality?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I told the psychiatrist, I told the psychologist, the counsellor. All of that was, it was, to go into St. Pat's for me was the most terrifying, well, it's the second terrifying thing I've done. This is the first. To go into St. Pat's on the 13th, and I initially felt like an absolute failure. I felt like I had absolutely failed in every walk of life, in everything I'd done. And I wasn't a real man. So I was admitted to St. Pat's, and on the 13th of October, as I said, and then on the first week of November, the 5th of November, I think it was, there was a phone call made from St. Pat's to Tina and to my stepdaughter, Becky. God, this is tough.
This is... Some of this phone call, of course, has been leaked. I'm just saying, I've heard this phone call.
It was recorded without my knowledge, and it was leaked without my knowledge. And that's all I can really say about that, because there's a criminal investigation into it.
I'm aware that I know that the guards are involved in this, but nonetheless, not to get into that side of it, that phone call, was that the catalyst for the separation, or what happened then? Because I could hear that was quite a distressed phone call.
Yeah.
And everybody was a bit distressed on the call.
Everybody was distressed. I don't actually remember it because I was on medication that I genuinely don't even remember the call. And it was, I thought it was my come to Jesus moment. And it was my chance to air my, just read the truth, but it wasn't the catalyst. We were already separated.
Okay.
I left my home on the 17th of September. So that was, the date of the separation was the 17th of September.
And we're going to hear more from Tommy Fleming after a short break. But I do want to say, if you have been affected by anything that you've heard in this first half of this interview, which was recorded earlier, help is available. You can contact the Samaritans on 116 123. Do stay with us. We'll be back after this with more on this exclusive interview with Tommy Fleming. Now, you're very welcome back to The Hard Shoulder. I should say that the text line has exploded in texts for Tommy Fleming, but we will get to them a little bit later on. I did speak with Tommy earlier before the show, and he did want to set the record straight on all that has happened and come out into the public domain over the last week. What I should say is there are aspects of this interview that do discuss mental health and sensitive issues, so some people may find this discussion triggering. I continued the interview with Tommy earlier by asking how his family were doing in all of this, and was it hard for Tina and his stepchildren and his family, and if they were hurting as well.
They're all hurting. They're all hurting at different levels, in different ways. There's anger, and I absolutely understand that anger. There's regret. There's a bucket full of words that you can use and emotions in here. And the only thing I can say is, you know, I'm absolutely remorseful and regretful for any of the hurt I've caused to the people I love in pursuing my truth or living my truth, whatever way I want to put it. And someday I hope I will never, I don't seek forgiveness. And I don't expect it. But I would hope, if there is a God, I would hope and pray that there would be acceptance.
Can I ask you, if Tina is listening to this, and I suspect she might listen to this, is there anything you would like to say to her now?
Exactly what I just said, that I can't undo the wrongs I've done. I can't. And I can't change the past. I can only look forward. I can only look ahead. And in order for me to survive, in order for me to have a life, I had to tell the truth. And own this, really. That's the best. Like, I mean, there's been a furore for the last number of weeks over many things. And of course, you get the keyboard warriors and you get the comments and you'll get the homophobic comments and you'll get the derogatory comments and you get all of that. And, you know, and obviously you'll get the one that's in the middle of that going, well, he's only a shite singer anyway. And
I don't think anyone's really going to say that.
And yet, for the first time in my life, the fear is gone.
Is that how you're feeling now?
I'm terrified right now, don't get me wrong. This is the most terrifying thing I've ever done. I think you can see that on me. If you were to ask me what would I want most in my life right now, is a night's sleep.
Are you not sleeping?
I haven't slept in a very, very long time.
Within the phone call, because I've heard it and lots of people who are listening to this will have heard it too, Tina said quite a lot of things to you. Obviously, she said you were going to gay saunas, you were looking at porn. She said you had STDs you could have given her, that you were covering them up with antibiotics. She accused you of taking drugs. A lot of that will have been heard by our listeners. Will you, I suppose, address some of those points? Did you put her at risk?
No, absolutely not. 100% didn't put her at risk.
Can you be sure of that?
100%.
What about drugs?
Yes. And what bracket I put this into is I put alcohol in there as well. Alcohol and substances were I medicated with them. They were a painkiller. To help me sleep. And it was across a broad spectrum of prescription medication, illegal substances, alcohol, all of the above that I dabbled with. And it's funny here, not in a ha-ha way, from the moment I left and the moment I stepped out on the ground or wherever I was as a gay man, the last thing I want is a drink. The last thing I want to do it was like a switch. It's like I'm not looking to numb something anymore. It's actually, a painkiller was the wrong word. It was an anesthetic. That's what it was.
Do you feel, Tommy? And I think it's a brave act to come out. I mean, you didn't have to do this. Nobody forced.
My hand was forced on this one.
Do you think?
Yeah. It's not that I wouldn't have come out. Even that word, I don't. The fact that you have to come out in 2026. I would never have, and I, it's not that I was going to be lying again about it. I'm not that type of person. I'm not going to be running down Grafton Street singing "I'm Coming Up" by Diana Ross. You know what I mean? This is not how I wanted to do this. And that recording.
Is that what forced your hand?
It did force my hand to a degree, but what it also did was take away my autonomy and take away. And this is the part that really, really gets to me. It took away me being able to stand in front of my siblings, my five siblings, who have circled the wagons around me for years on different things. And we're a very close family. And what it took away was my right to be able to stand in front of them and give them the respect of telling them the truth. It also took away my privacy in my suicide attempt in September. That was never meant for the public.
Take a minute, you're doing okay.
That was something that never.
Would you have preferred if that had never been something that was known in the public domain?
Yeah. I would.
Broadening this all out for people listening, how difficult is it to live a life as a gay man while, I suppose, pretending in public and in a very public way because of you are in the public eye that you're not?
Jekyll and Hyde, if you want, for one analogy, or almost like the Johnston twins in Blood Brothers. You almost end up with a split personality. If I'm honest. Because on each side you're lying. The scales are very balanced on that side of it.
And this maybe is a hard question. Is it possible to still love your wife, love your family, like love them, and have a separate life as well?
I always loved them. I always will. Towards the end, it's a different type of love than it was in the beginning. It is. It is possible. But it's not possible to be in that union. It's just not. You know, because two people are very unhappy then, not just one.
If you had your time over, would you do things differently?
Great question. I always lived my life with no regrets. I've always had the attitude of I never go back down the road I came up. All of that. Yeah, I would. Honestly, truth be known, I would. If the world had been a different place, if rural Ireland was a very different place, if, let's call a spade, if Catholic Ireland were a different place.
Were you, I know your most, one of your most famous recordings, of course, in Knock Basilica, were you a religious young man?
When I was very young, I suppose pre-teenage, I would have been, you're afraid not to be. I rebelled as a teenager with it. I had a huge problem with it. And if it was to be delved deeper, if my problem was exactly where I'm sitting here today with you talking about.
I know you campaigned in the Yes Equality referendum because you have a nephew who's gay, and you were more campaigning on his behalf.
Mm-hmm.
Was it easier to look for rights for him than to look for them for yourself?
It's not that it was easier. It was the least I could do, because I felt like a coward. I wasn't able to help pave a path for him. I wasn't able to help the people that all those gay men that died in the 80s, I was just the generation behind that. And this was the only thing I could do. And it was under, because everyone was on that bandwagon. Straight, gay, bi, whatever they were, they were on that bandwagon. So you could go on that bandwagon without getting labelled. I was very controlled in how I did it. But then again, I was very controlled in everything I did. I had been controlled.
You were obviously a gay man in the closet for up until more or less now. Did people, other gay men, ever recognise you? I don't mean in gay saunas or places maybe you went and sought out company, but were you ever out and about in your life and someone saying, are you gay? Are you gay, Tommy? Were you asked?
you'd be asked out. You'd be hit on.
So other gay men recognised you?
And as soon as that happened, the coward in me came out. You left exactly where you were, and you left your drink on the table and you got out of there. You protected that secret at every cost. You were almost like, if somebody recognised you, it was almost like you were found out in the witness protection programme. You know, and you you just got out of there. The fear took hold. And you just got out of there.
You said if you had your time over, you'd do things differently. And I'm not suggesting that you should do this. And I do understand, I think I sort of understand the life that you've lived and the difficulties that it created for you. And I think you've been very honest about that and about your own behaviour and drink and drugs and all sorts. So I'm not suggesting there is anybody, but is there anyone that you feel you'd like to say sorry to, or you owe an apology to, or is that not the way it sits in your head?
It does sit in my head. It's...
I don't mean for being gay.
I'm not going to apologise for that. No.
No, and that's not what I meant at all. I mean for your own behaviours around it.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, my family, my wife, my stepchildren. There's so many people that were impacted. And some of them knew the truth. And I don't want to individualise anybody, because you can't make chalk one and cheese of the other. And yeah, my how it impacted my wife, there's a lot of hurt caused here. There's an awful lot of hurt caused, not intentionally. It's almost like it's always that question in your head which goes, what the fuck were you thinking? And those questions have stopped.
In terms of your mental health, I know you obviously reached a crisis point last year. Are you in a better place now, or is it still a long road?
The best way to explain this one, if the last 2 weeks were to have happened 6 or 7 months ago, I don't think I would have survived it. It happened now. I cannot control what people will do or what they'll say, or how they react or what they think. I cannot, and I'm not going to try. So, what's most important to me right now is my mental health, is my family, my closest friends. That's what's important to me right now. My music, actually.
You've gigs coming up. Are you going to perform?
Oh yeah, I'm absolutely going to perform. It's the one place I can stand for 2.5 hours and I don't have to think about anything else. That's the best therapy I've ever had. And when everything reached crisis and when I just couldn't do this anymore and September came, I didn't listen to music at all until probably February. I never listened to one tune. I never listened to a song. I never listened to anything.
And I presume you're someone who listens to music.
I used to listen to music all the time. It healed. It helped heal anyway, I thought. I loved so many different types of music. And then where that love was instilled into me was from my mum and dad. And they were the two most liberal, understanding people.
Did they know?
I'd say my mum knew. Jesus, did they know? Did anybody know? It's the worst kept secret in Ireland.
It is now, Tommy.
I was just saying to Frankie there from the PR team. Don't take this the wrong way. I'm glad my mum and dad aren't here to have to deal with this. There's one good thing there.
And maybe lastly, and maybe it's too hard of a question for you to know at this point, but what next for Tommy Fleming?
As I said to you earlier, if I can get a night's sleep, if I can quell the noise, and what's next? I hope to be able to stand back on a stage at some point and sing it with not just in the smaller shows that we're doing that I dipped my foot into, because I hadn't done anything in almost a year, and I didn't even know if I could sing again. I didn't even know if I did. I never even sang in the shower for those months. Yeah, I turned 55 today. I will always remember my 55th birthday. Thankfully, I'm young enough to be able to live my life. Hopefully that this is the start of the rest of my life. And only I can deal with the guilt, the remorse, the regret, all of those things. Only I can deal with those things. And I can only deal with them as best as I can. And if they become too much at some point, then I have to park that for a certain amount of time until I can deal with it.
Tommy Fleming, thank you very much for talking to us.
Thank you, Ciara. Thank you for the platform to tell the truth.
And that was recorded with Tommy Fleming a little bit earlier on, and we are sincerely grateful to him for sharing and trusting us with his story. If you have been affected by anything that you've heard today, help is available. You can contact the Samaritans on 116 123.
The Hard Shoulder with Ciara Kelly and Shane Coleman.
With Kia.
Weekdays at 4 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.